sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Noah Levy, discussing the Israeli electorate and Israeli culture today. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Our Shinshinim are young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mavena on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy holiday of Chanukah. It's the seventh day of Chanukah today, meaning tonight is the eighth and final night. We talk about this enjoyable Jewish festival quite a lot and always emphasize its importance, commemorating the victory of the few over the many, the weak over the strong, and especially those who wanted to practice their faith over those who wished to stop them from doing so. Chanukah, at heart, is about fighting for religious freedom, a great and abiding theme that has resonance for every religion and culture. During this holiday, we also rhapsodize about latkes, Jewish potato and onion pancakes, the most delicious food ever created, and quite possibly the least healthy, or sufganiyot, the Israeli version of a jelly donut, also tasty, also magnificently and unapologetically anti-nutritional. It's a wonderful time of year for parties, Hanukkah menorah lighting, eating, gift-giving, a secondary but now standard part of this festival of lights. But there's one aspect of Hanukkah that we tend not to talk about much, and that is the game of dreidel, sevivon, the traditional contest of spinning tops that we're supposed to engage in over this eight-day holiday. Dreidel is actually a Yiddish word. It comes from the word drei, which means to go round and round like a spinning top does. That word is used in other contexts. We say a confused person is a dreikop, and that the rabbi who goes on too long in his or her elliptically extended sermon drays on and on. The Hebrew word is sevivon, kind of the same idea from the word savav, to go around or encircle. The dreidel, or sevivon itself, has a point on the bottom and four flat sides, each embossed with a single Hebrew letter. In Israel, those letters are Nun, Gimel, He, and Pe, which stand for the words Nes Gadol Haya Po, a great miracle happened here. But outside of Israel, where most of us live, here in the rest of the world, the diaspora, the letters stand for Nes Gadol Haya Sham, a great miracle happened there. Both acronyms are supposed to allude to the miraculous victory of the Maccabees over the great Syrian Greek armies of Antiochus IV Epiphanes back in the 2nd century BCE. And when your dreidel lands, the letter showing on top dictates what you do. It's a kind of unskilled gambling game, like a simplified version of throwing dice. There's a pool of chocolate coins or nuts in the middle. When your dreidel lands with the gimel showing, you take the whole pot. He means take half the pot, nun means you don't do anything, and shin means you put in a few coins or nuts. Rabbis have gone to great lengths to prove that this little game has mighty historical associations. In order to suppress resistance, the Syrian Greeks prohibited Jews from learning Torah. That's true. So one 19th century rabbi maintained the Jews played dreidel in order to fool the Greeks by teaching the lesson of Hanukkah in subterfuge. And if they were caught studying Torah, which was outlawed, they could claim they were just playing dreidel. Mind you, that was in the 19th century, more than 2,000 years after the original events. Other rabbis calculated elaborate word plays and gematriot for the letters Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin. For example, Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin in Talmudic numerology equals 358, and that is the numerical equivalent of Mashiach in Hebrew or Messiah. Ah! Therefore, dreidel must be a messianic game. One late explanation says the letters Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin are supposed to represent the four kingdoms that tried to destroy us in the ancient world. Nun is King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, who burned the first temple. He is Haman, who attempted genocide of the Jews in Persia in the Book of Esther. Gimel is Greece, the home culture of Antiochus, who tried to stop us from practicing Judaism in the time of the Maccabees. And Shin, or Sin, equals Seir, a euphemism from Rome, which destroyed the Second Temple. Look, actually, the Game of Dreidel originally had nothing to do with Hanukkah. And it didn't start in the time of the Maccabees, or in the ancient world, or even in the medieval world, nor did we Jews invent it. It has been played by various peoples in various languages for about 500 years. In fact, in England and Ireland, there was a game called Teetotum that is especially popular at Christmas time. The name comes from the Latin word totum, which means all. The game is first mentioned around the year 1500. By 1801, however, the four letters on the side of the top in teetotum represented four words in English. T equals take all, H is half, P is put down, and N was nothing. Our Jewish Eastern European game of dreidel is directly based on the German equivalent of this totem game. N equals nichts, or nothing. G equals ganz, or all. H equals halb, or half, and S equals stell ein, which means put in German. The dreidel game represents a kind of irony of Jewish history, therefore. In order to celebrate the holiday of Hanukkah, our great victory over cultural assimilation, we play dreidel, which itself is a great example of cultural assimilation. Of course, there's a world of difference between imitating non-Jewish games and worshipping idols, but the irony remains. I've always thought Hanukkah celebrates the victory of Jews 2,200 years ago over aspects of culture that are now finally winning over the Maccabees' descendants in today's American Judaism. Our ancestors fought for religious practice and Jewish learning against the Greek emphasis on athletics and theatrical presentations of drama, music, and comedy. Today, most American Jews seem to prefer the athletics and the theatrical presentations over religious practice and learning. In any case, the main problem with dreidel is that the game is kind of dumb. Somebody spins a gimel and there's nothing left in the pot, and then you go on spinning for a long time until that person loses enough of his or her winnings to make the game interesting for everybody else. We've modified it in my home so that you have to ante some of your precious chocolate coins each spin. That speeds the game up and increases competition. Now, if I can just convince everybody to play for actual money, you know, like $100 a spin, well, then we'll really have something. Anyway, to play us in this morning on the dreidel theme, here's a Hanukkah tune about just that from the Levy's album, Hanukkah Rocks, theoretically recorded in just 8 days a few years back.
Sometimes you gotta plug one in. Other times you just might take your pot. So let's do this once again. Kitchen table dreidelin'. Pick it up, give it a spin.
That was the Levy's dreidel anthem, Nun Gimel Hey Shin. Our guest this morning, Noah Levy, is an Israeli academic who's a visiting professor at the University of Chicago, an expert on Israeli culture and the young Israeli electorate. Find out what's going on in an area that has incredibly important implications for the future of the Jewish state when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Noah Levy is Associate Professor of Sociology of Culture and Communication at the Academic College of Tel Aviv Jaffa, and she is currently an Israel Institute Visiting Scholar at the renowned University of Chicago. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
Boker Tov. Tell us a little bit about the sociology of culture and communication and what that means.
Sociology of culture and communication is actually the study of culture and communication through a perspective which regards culture and communication and all aspects of communication like television, film, radio, advertising, etc.,
so,
literature.
But also social media and
social media,
online,
everything, yeah.
Everything, okay.
And we study it as sociologists through a lens which regards everything as part of social institutions and also reflecting social inequalities, politics, etc. We look at society as a construct and not as something which has its own meaning, rather than it is something which is constructed through political and sociological forces.
So, for example, while people are trying to understand how Israel is changing, you know, it seems more Americanized, that's way too simplistic, isn't it?
Of course. Israel is changing in many complex and conflicting ways. In many ways, you can say that Israel culturally is Americanized, but as an Israeli and also as a sociologist, I can tell you that it's not the whole picture. We have, you know, adopted American values, especially capitalism and neoliberalism. But on the other hand, Israel is going through processes of being more and more religious than it used to be. Which is actually the opposite of liberal values which enforce capitalism. If you think about capitalism as, you know, freedom of something, the freedom to pursue your own assets and money, in Israel this freedom is regarded as actually sacred, much like as in the United States, but the freedom to pursue beliefs, ways of life, styles, etc., this is actually deteriorated into more or regressed into a more conservative point of view. And so so this is one conflicting trend. The other one is also like actually cultural assets like music and art, etc. On the one hand, Israeli music is the popular Israeli music is now less Americanized and more like Arabic, but
yeah,
in
more
a
Middle
cosmopolitan
Eastern
way,
right,
more
right,
Middle
right.
Eastern, yeah. Exactly. So in many Israel. Ways, even though we are still, you know, going through or having conflict with our Arab neighbors and Palestinian neighbors, the Israeli culture is in many, many ways part now of the Middle East, and like and in many other ways, Israeli TV is very successful in the United States, like series like Fauda or Shtisel, which talk about Israeli culture, but do it in a way which appeals to American audience through Netflix, but also to Arab audience, like, I don't know if you know, but Fauda, which is a series about an Israeli IDF undercover unit in Gaza and the West Bank, in Gaza and the West Bank, is a huge success in the United States, in Israel, and in Gaza and the West Bank itself, and, yeah. And in other Arab countries. So we see a lot of conflicting trends which bring about, I think, a society or a culture which is in a constant state of fluctuation and dynamic. And being such a young country and a young culture, I think it's not unique that we're going through these, you know, major changes in short periods of times. And I think that this is really a very interesting, study area, which is also my area of study, fascinating. And it also reflects on Israeli politics, because Israeli politics nowadays, as part of Israeli culture, is changing. It's becoming more Americanized in ways, or even it's becoming more social media politics like in the United States in many ways. And young people, like young people in the United States, are actually getting sick and tired of old politics and what they call old politics,
right,
and looking for something new.
Well, we'll explore the political implications of this much more when we return. Great interview here with Noah Levy on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a one-year-old Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha has now moved to larger quarters in our new synagogue location, 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us this Friday night at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla. Our very first Shabbat services in our new location are at 6:30 p.m. They'll be preceded by Tat Kabbalat Shabbat services for families with young children at 5:30 p.m., songs and stories, and, of course, a great and tasty Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. New synagogue is at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. We're not in the mall, on the south side in our own building, and we'll be there for a while. Join us in 2020 at Ina, west of La Cholla. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, including a new introductory Judaism class, and of course all of our services, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing synagogue in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. In the spirit of this final day of a very special holiday and its eight crazy nights, here's Adam Sandler's fourth and maybe final version of his Hanukkah song.
Put on the yarmulke. So much Hanukkah to celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the festival of lights. Instead of one day of presents, we get eight crazy nights. When you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree, here's the fourth list of people who are Jewish. Just like Jesus, Olaf, Punky Brewster, Scott Rudin, and me. Joseph Gordon-Levitt enjoys eating kugel. So does Stanley, Jake Gyllenhaal, and the two guys who founded Google. Adam Levine wears a Jewish star, so does Drake and Seth Rogen. Goldberg has a gold yarmulke to match the belt he won from Hulk Hogan. We got Scarlett Johansson, talk about a kosher crush. And if you need a higher voice to turn you on, how about Geddy Lee from We may not have a cartoon with the reindeer that can talk, but we also don't have polio, thanks to Dr. Jonas Salk, smart Jew. Put on your yarmulke, it's time for Hanukkah. Harry Potter and his magic wanaka, celebrate Hanukkah. Jared from Subway.
God damn it, a Jew! But guess who's Jewish and can fix him? Loveline's Dr. Drew. Get on it, Doc! Princess Leia cuts the challah with Queen Elsa from Frozen. David Beckham is the king of soccer studs and also a quarter chosen. Ron Jeremy's fully Jewish and so's his footlong buddy.
That was Adam Sandler's fourth edition of his Hanukkah song for the final night of Hanukkah tonight. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from 2JewishRadio.com or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You've been sharing with us your experience at this remarkable Jewish conference in Montenegro, including the opening ceremonies, which had the president of Montenegro, ministers from Israel, the appointment of the first chief rabbi of Montenegro, all kinds of ceremonial stuff, all kinds of important people showing up. I hate to say this, but why so much interest in what cannot be considered a huge Jewish community?
Right. I mean, if there's a Jewish community there at all, it probably numbers fewer than 200.
Dozens or something, right?
But what happens in a lot of these places is once there's a charismatic rabbi and a little bit of activity and a little bit of singing and a little bit of schnapps, Jews start coming out of the woodwork. And certainly this is the case in Kiev, where I think maybe the official number of Jews is like 30,000. But people there tell me the real number of Jews, if you don't go strictly by Jewish law and by the Israeli definition of who's a Jew, but if you count anybody who has a Jewish mother, Jewish father, a Jewish grandfather who says I'm Jewish and I feel some connection toward the Jewish people, the number is really like 600,000.
Oh my gosh.
Which is a huge difference.
That'd be the second largest Jewish community in America, for
right.
example.
But again, depending on how you define Jew. So I think the hope of Chabad in places like Montenegro is that once you start the ball rolling, people will come out of the woodwork and remember their grandmother who lit candles every Friday night or whatever, and will want to learn more. And of course, one of the techniques used by Chabad is they get you to do one thing, perform one act of mitzvah, whether it's lighting Shabbat candles or lighting Hanukkah candles or putting on tefillin, whatever it is, to make you feel more connected. I mean, I saw these rabbis in action. It was extremely interesting because the participants of the conference came from all the countries of the former Yugoslavia, also all the countries of the Yugoslav exile, which is pretty much the whole world, plus all the neighboring countries, which were not generally Yugoslav exiles, but Jews from Greece, Bulgaria, Turkey, who were all originally Ottoman, and also northern neighbors like Hungary and Austria. There was one guy who grew up in Sarajevo, very famous Jewish family there, who made most of his career as a gynecologist in Geneva. So his most comfortable language with me was French, because my French is way better than my Serbian. But he interrogated me in about 12 languages. I think partially to show me that he was multilingual.
He knew 12 languages.
Very smart guy. Lots of good stories. He's one of the people who helped make me aware of the Sarajevo Purim. And, you know, this was one of those rare occasions in life where in the same day, I could have conversations in 12 different languages and do so usefully. It got tiring. But the Chabad presence as time wore on got less and less visible. At the end, there was only the Chabad rabbi from Belgrade, the Chabad rabbi from Split, and the new Chabad rabbi in Montenegro. They managed to close the hotel to anyone not participating in the conference. They koshered the kitchen, so all meals were fully kosher with a couple little asterisks. They didn't want to risk having dairy and meat in the same kitchen. The hotel only had one kitchen, however big it was. So at breakfast, they served no dairy products, which drew a lot of protests from people all over the former Yugoslavia, for whom the stuff you eat in Israel that varies from sort of thick sour cream to thin buttermilk and every consistency in between, basically sour milk products, plus white cheese, like feta cheese or whatever, that's incredibly important in the Balkans. And the rabbi said, yeah, but I'm giving you hot dogs instead. And I said, we don't want hot dogs at breakfast. Meat twice a day is enough. Meat is important in our culture, but not three times a day. So he learned something for next year, and there will be changes. The other thing that was strange was, because the hotel still needs to make money, the waiters were allowed to sell local Montenegrin wine and serve it to you at the table with your kosher meat and your
even
kosher chicken soup.
You know,
exactly.
It wasn't anything. Right. Thanks, Tom. Fascinating experience, and maybe you'll go back.
Oh, I definitely will go back.
Take care. We welcome Inbal Shtivi, our shlicha on Israel from the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Inbal.
Boker Tov. Nice to be here.
And it's sort of the end of Chanukah, last night of Chanukah tonight, Chag Sameach, there's another holiday coming up, which it always surprises me that Israelis celebrate New Year's Eve. And how they do it, can you explain this a little?
Yeah. Well, as one can imagine, the celebration of the end of the calendar year, 31st December, 1st January, is usually celebrated within the more secular part of Israel.
Right.
Ultra-Orthodox in Jerusalem do not see it as
an
occasion.
Rosh Hashanah was the new year.
Rosh Hashanah was the new year, and there are so many other holidays and festivities.
Many holidays.
Mostly it's celebrated among
secular
Chilonim
right.
Populations. It is also very big within Russian-speaking community in Israel.
Which is more than a million strong. I mean, there are many, many Russian Jews who came over from the former Soviet Union.
Exactly. So it's a big community. And, of course, all the Christians that live in Israel, which are workers, immigrants for work,
visitors
and other
people. You know, Christian Arabs
and of course the Christian Arabs. Yes,
population in Israel.
Yes,
million, I don't know.
So 20% are Arabs, and among them,
a number of
Christians. Yeah,
sure.
Some sort of.
So there's a name for it in Israel that in America we look blank at. It. Sylvester.
Yeah.
Who was Sylvester? Why did I?
Sylvester was there is a story about Sylvester that I cannot actually remember now.
I know it's a Christian martyrdom story,
Christian,
and maybe it was a pope, and there's some controversy.
It's completely Christian. We don't study about Sylvester in our education system.
No, I wouldn't think so.
No worries. Yeah. And we don't celebrate.
But we don't either here in America.
We don't celebrate the figure of Sylvester, the person,
or the
myth of Sylvester. We celebrate the night
of December
31st and saying Happy New Year, because it is the end
New
of
Year's
the calendar
Eve.
Year.
That's right.
It is the end of the tax year. It is the end of December.
Yes. So, it's going to be 2020. It's going to be a new decade.
Yeah. And people have great parties and it's very nice.
So it's just fun.
It's just fun. No one really believes that
it has any other significance.
The Jewish ones, at least.
And unlike America, nobody gets up early the next morning to watch the Rose Parade or to see the football bowl games.
People go to work. that's what they do after farting all night. They just get up in the morning.
Get up in the morning and go to
work.
Sorry
for themselves and saying, oh, next year I should take the day off.
Shouldn't drink so much that night.
Or something,
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, listen, happy secular New Year. Happy Sylvester.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Inbal. We'll talk next year.
Yeah, of course. Thanks.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew. Brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A young Jewish man excitedly tells his mother he's fallen in love and he's going to get married. He says, just for fun, Ma, I'm going to bring over three women. You try to guess which one I'm going to marry. His mother agrees. The next day, he brings three beautiful women into the house, sits them on the couch. They all chat for a while with his mother. He then says, okay, Ma, guess which one I'm going to marry. She immediately replies, the redhead in the middle. That's amazing, Ma. You're right. How did you know? And she says, her, I don't like.
That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, here for the Weintraub Israel Center, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
And Chag Chanukah Sameach.
Chagash.
So, this is the halfway mark for you guys. You've been here 6 months. You spend, I mean, it's not exactly 6 months. I don't know. It's five and a half, five-ish. Whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But you've now, you're really at the halfway mark. You're going to go back to Israel, reemerge in your own culture for a little bit, or reimmerse in your own culture. What observations do you have at this point, at this halfway point? What's different? What should you expect? You know, what's
so
similar?
There's a famous common sentence that you say about a year service like this, that every week feels like a month and every month feels like a week. So I don't know if I feel that way or not, but it has been crazy. I mean, it's hard to think that we just arrived in August and it's December already, which is insane when you think about that.
Like we say, when you're busy, a day feels like a week.
Like we do
a week
so much.
Feels like a day. Yeah, that's
exactly.
Right.
We do so much, and then like we can't realize we're already like in Hanukkah. It's crazy.
Yeah. Shai, how about you? What's your first thoughts on this halfway point?
Wow. I cannot describe how fast it went. Like day by day was really long, and then coming back late to home. But now, like, I'm seeing the whole picture, and yesterday it was my last time at one congregation, and they did something for me, and they gave me something, it was really excited for me, and then I took a moment for myself, and I was thinking, wow, like, it was so fast, I couldn't imagine that it will be so fast, and I couldn't imagine that also I will succeed in the way of giving them my Israeli.
Your Israel experience. Giving them your experience in Israel.
I think the Jewish community, not just in here, the Jewish communities around the world, Judaism and Israelism comes together. I think they think that the religion of Judaism comes together with Israel. So they think all the Israelis know the prayers. Since they are little kids, they go to synagogues and they practice prayers, and that's the whole thing that they do.
And it's totally
and
not
it's totally
accurate.
Not accurate at all, because I've been here more synagogues than I have ever been to Israel.
In your whole life?
In my whole life.
Right.
And it's kind of...
Well, I think the distinction that the vitality of the American Jewish community is in the synagogues.
Right.
In Israel, it's sort of the whole country.
It's sort of the whole country, talking about the same topics as you talk about here in the States, but...
We talk about it in the synagogue in Israel. Right. You talk about it in the street.
Right. Yeah. I think that's my observation.
It's a great observation. Danielle, how about you?
Well, to be honest, I thought when I just first arrived, like was about to come, I was expecting to be the one to give information. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I've gotten so much more than what I was expecting. I mean, I think I got more from everyone than what I... got to give. I learned so much about myself, about what's being like, how people are being Jews in just like different kind of ways. I mean, I've lived in two other countries. This is like my fourth country living in and just like experiencing it. Mm-hmm. And it has been the most far like craziest and like unexpected for me, I would say. I mean, I've never been so much in one synagogue, and in my free time, I usually have like hearing radio songs and have them stuck in my head. I actually sing in my free time just like prayer songs that I hear in the synagogue.
You're singing prayers that you hear in the
crazy
show.
I mean, it's my jam now. It's all I hear.
I have to say, you know, all of the Shin Shinim, we've had wonderful Shin Shinim here. We've been really blessed with you two especially, but everybody has been great. They all say the same thing. I learned so much more than I expected to learn. Even people that lived in America when they were younger. And it's really, I think, an extraordinary sharing of experience. And by the way, people love you guys here on the radio show, so I have to share that too. Listen, have a great trip to Israel, and Shana Tova.
We're just running to our flight, so bye-bye.
We will talk soon. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Vayigash begins with the climax of the great Joseph story that fills the last sections of the book of Genesis. Joseph is now the powerful ruler of Egypt, richest country of the ancient world. His miraculous ascent from slavery and prison to the heights of political power is the stuff that dreams are made of. He is master of all he surveys, subservient only to a pharaoh who trusts him completely. Joseph is handsome, rich, hugely powerful, has a wife and two fine sons. He's completely assimilated into Egypt's elegant culture, and he's still comparatively young. The world sits at his manicured feet. But wait, there's more. For into this idyllic scene blunder Joseph's early tormentors, the very half-brothers who taunted him and beat him up. These are the conniving thugs who stripped him, tossed him into a pit in the earth, and sat down to eat lunch, debating in his hearing whether to kill him or just abandon him to die of thirst and starvation, and then thoughtfully sold him into slavery in a foreign land instead. Now, 20 years later or so, he has had the opportunity to return the favor, to exact at least a psychological vengeance on these half-brothers. After a sequence of twists and turns, Joseph has manipulated them into a state of confusion and terror, unmanned these arrogant, unruly rural ruffians into fearful submission. Joseph has had his dish of revenge served cold, and he seems to have enjoyed it. And then something changes in Joseph. Perhaps he simply tires of psychologically torturing his half-brothers. Perhaps it's that he's finally seen his full brother, Benjamin, again, the only living reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. Perhaps it's that the fullest measure of revenge is magnanimity. Perhaps it's simply that Joseph's exceptional ability to act pragmatically exerts himself. He must end the cat-and-mouse game one way or another. Or perhaps it's the stirring confessional speech that his powerful half-brother Judah delivers that now brings Joseph to a new place. Near the beginning of Vayigash, in the dramatic high point of the story, Joseph chooses to be reunited with his family. He sends out the advisors, counselors, courtiers. He cries out in a voice loud enough to be heard by all. He tells the brothers that he is Joseph. Weeping now, he embraces his brother Benjamin, asking, "Is my father still alive?" One can imagine the shock of that moment, even now, 3,600 years after the events. The brothers may have had an inkling that he was indeed Joseph. It's implied in the story. But the full revelation must have been stunning nonetheless. Their worst fears are realized. They are now completely in the power of a despised half-brother they comprehensively wronged. What will happen? Joseph moves immediately to reassure them, to relieve their fears. He gently reminds them that he is the authority now. Everyone will move down to Egypt and live in land he provides. Jacob comes down to Egypt too. The family is reassembled, but in a very different configuration, for the unquestioned new patriarch is Joseph, and the great story continues in a new land and a new direction. There's something about this story that compels us to examine our assumptions about how things work in our world. Unpredictable things occur. What we expect is often not what happens. Fate plays a role. And in the best of circumstances, and with God's help, our own actions, like Joseph's, may begin with base motivation and yet ultimately rise to a level of magnanimity and grace. Our guest this morning, Noah Levy, is an Israeli academic who understands the young Israeli electorate as well as anybody. Perhaps she can explain what's going on in politics in Israel and in Israeli culture when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, President Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, claimed in a new interview that he's more of a Jew than billionaire philanthropist George Soros, a Holocaust survivor. "Don't tell me I'm anti-Semitic if I oppose him," Giuliani, raised as a Roman Catholic, said. "Soros is hardly a Jew. I'm more of a Jew than Soros is. I probably know more about. He doesn't go to church, he doesn't go to religion, synagogue." The former New York mayor also accused Soros of being an enemy of Israel and called him a horrible human being. Born in Hungary, Soros, then a teenager, young teenager, and his family survived Nazi occupation by falsifying identity papers and concealing the fact they were Jews. Soros emigrated to the U.S. in the 1950s, starting his own hedge fund in 1970, and has since supported liberal and democratic causes through his Open Society foundations. Conspiracy theorists have seized on his immense wealth, patronage of liberal causes, and Jewish heritage, making him a frequent target of the far right in his native Hungary, and, of course, right here in the U.S. Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, wrote that Giuliani's attacks against Soros were anti-Semitic, in fact. Opposing Soros isn't what's anti-Semitic, Greenblatt said. Saying that he controls ambassadors, employs FBI agents, and isn't Jewish enough to be demonized is. Giuliani also pushed an unfounded claim of his that Soros is backing former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch, the career diplomat who was removed from her post in Kiev earlier this year following attacks by Giuliani. He has invented and publicized the theory that George Soros has been hiding dirt on Democrats in Ukraine and that Soros, not the Russian government that the entire U.S. intelligence community has found to be guilty, was responsible for intervening in the 2016 election. Giuliani said, without providing any evidence, he put all four ambassadors there and he's employing the FBI agents. Yovanovitch denied the allegations during her private deposition in October and again during public testimony in November. Giuliani said in an interview that he needed to get Yovanovitch out of the way as he tried digging up dirt on Democrats on behalf of his client, President Trump. And just in time for Hanukkah, the holiday of Sufganiyot, the Israeli version of jelly donuts, the German parent company of Krispy Kreme is making war reparations to Holocaust families. The Reimann family, a major German industrial family whose ancestors had significant ties to the Nazis, will now donate tens of millions of dollars to support Holocaust survivors and former forced laborers from the Nazi era. In addition to one-time donations to the claims conference and individual laborers, the Reimann family's firm has created a foundation to distribute about $30 million annually to programs teaching about the Holocaust and democratic values. This announcement comes months after the family, which is worth over $20 billion, said historians they commissioned to explore the company history found that its Nazi-era directors were dedicated National Socialists who severely abused slave laborers. The company's successor, JAB, is known worldwide for brands such as Krispy Kreme, Pete's Coffee, and Coty. With the knowledge that their firm had built its success on the backs of slaves, the firm's current directors announced their plans to make amends. During the Nazi era, the company was owned and directed by Albert Reimann and his son Albert Jr. The latter married Emily Landecker, daughter of Alfred Landecker. As a baptized Catholic, she continued to work for the company even after her father was deported in 1942. Her husband ultimately adopted the three children that Emily had with another man. Two of them are among the four shareholders of JAB. That means the family has Jewish blood. Landecker, who was murdered by the Nazis, has a foundation that's part of this compensation named for him. Reimann and his son were early supporters of the Nazis, making donations even before Hitler rose to power in 1933. In a statement that came from the Claims Conference, the partnership with the Jewish organization is considered to be a significant step for the Alfred Landecker Foundation, the ambition of researching and remembering the atrocities of the Holocaust, providing humanitarian assistance for survivors of the Holocaust, and former forced labor in World War II. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back our guest this morning, Dr. Noa Lavie. She is the Associate Professor of Sociology of Culture and Communication at the Academic College of Tel Aviv Jaffa and an Israel Institute Visiting Scholar at the University of Chicago. So I have to back up a little, explain, because one of those changes that are going on in Israeli society are things like the Academic College of Tel Aviv Jaffa, which I was not aware of until fairly recently. Tell me, you know, some of those developments a little bit.
Well, these developments started around the early 90s, and they were part of neoliberal and privatization processes. In Israel, we used to have like four universities. We had Tel Aviv University, the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and Haifa University, etc. And then during the early 90s, when Israel opened up to capitalism, neoliberalism, etc., one of the ideas of the government then, which was the Rabin government, was to open up education to you know, the cultural and social and economic and economic periphery. So they formed a law which was called the Colleges Law, and through this law, many public colleges were opened around the country. And one of them was the Tel Aviv Academic College, which was first established as part of the Tel Aviv University, and then we got, you know, we became our own institution. These are all state-financed public colleges, and they were supposed to bring higher education, academic education, to the minorities of Israel in the periphery, which means more Mizrahi Israelis and Arabs, etc. But eventually, this law, which was hastily actually done without a lot of thinking behind it, like many, many laws in Israel, unfortunately, because of its being a young country, etc., it became these colleges, which were supposed to, you know, help the periphery, they actually did that, but in a way also reinforced social gaps, because my college in Tel Aviv, which is actually in Jaffa, and that is why it's called like a social periphery of Tel Aviv, because Jaffa is a part where Arabs live, etc. My college became one of the top colleges, and we also have now like many scholars who also do research, etc., and becoming more and more university-like, which actually prohibits people with, you know, from weaker communities to enroll to this college. On the other the other side of it is that still this college is publicly financed, and it's not as expensive as private colleges in Israel, which are now as expensive as the University of Chicago, if you know what I mean. So
yeah.
It's,
like the Interdisciplinary Institute in Herzliya, for example.
Exactly. Right. So one of the reasons I love teaching and being a faculty at the Tel Aviv Academic College is, first, I'm also a graduate of this college, and I'm one of the first graduate people from there who got tenure there, and I went on to get my master's and PhD at the Tel Aviv University. And also, I love the work we do with the population of Jaffa, and the way we still, you know, can offer high education, academic education, which is really, really good to people who come from diverse backgrounds. So, of course, I can keep on talking about colleges and universities and private colleges in Israel for hours, but this is, in a nutshell, the story.
No, I think it's great because Israel was known, you know, it had a few great national universities, Hebrew University, Tel Aviv University, Technion, then Ben-Gurion. But, you know, there weren't that many colleges that kids could go to.
Now there are too many colleges.
Right.
They opened too many colleges, and there are not enough students
for
to
all
come
the colleges,
study
right.
For all the colleges. And now they're starting to, you know, minimize them or lower
or
the number
them,
and,
right,
and consolidate, etc. And of course, we have the very, very private, expensive ones like the IDC, or even we have the Ariella's former college, which became a university. So there are a lot of, you know, like the Israeli culture, so academic life is also fluctuating and changing.
Like everything else in Israel.
Now the very thorny issue of politics in Israel, because Israel is going to end up having three national elections in less than a year. I'm very curious, first of all, what's going on with the Israeli electorate, but also what's going on with young Israeli voters.
Okay, so first of all, the fact that we have our third election in 1 year is very disturbing, because it implies that the bases of the baselines of Israeli democracy are actually they're under attack. Like Israel was always, you know, known to be the only democracy in the Middle East, and now the politics of Israel is becoming more and more like places which are not democratic. You know, if we have to go to our third election in 1 year, it means that the democracy is in a state of danger, endangered. And the Israeli electorate, people who go to vote, Israel is very, very divided. For the past 10 years, living in Israel, growing up in Israel, and loving Israel, I've sadly seen Israeli society torn apart by politicians and hatred they're actually Israeli society, which was once really, you felt the unity, is now divided into fractures, and these fractures don't get along. And they, like, if you talk or you watch the debate between the lefties and the right wings in Israel, it's like two different countries, and they cannot even talk to each other or understand each other. And the first election, which was held, in April 2019, was actually concluded by Netanyahu not willing to give the mandate to form a coalition back to our president. And this was a shocking thing in Israeli democracy. This is something that no one has done before. And this was actually saying that, okay, we have the laws, and the law says that if you can't form a coalition, you have to give it back to the president and give it to the, to the other party. And Netanyahu didn't do it. So then we went to another election, which was also a tie, and also we have, Netanyahu being indicted, etc. So he needs to stay a prime minister. For him not to go to trial, because Israeli law actually helps or protects the politicians who are suspected of corruption. So we're going to a third election, and all Israeli society and voters know that this is actually the third time we go to elect, because Netanyahu needs to stay prime minister in order not to go to trial. And then you have the division. Half of the population thinks that he should do it, and people are actually saying that there's no replacement for him. It's like, you know, like, and they don't really even want elections. They just want him to keep on being prime minister. And the other half of Israel is disturbed by the fact that actually we can't seem to switch our prime minister, because we don't have a law which prohibits him to reign more. We don't have your very smart American law saying that the president can only reign for 8 years.
Boy, there's so much to unpack, and unfortunately we're out of time. Love to have you come back when we talk about the results of the next election. It's almost...
Hopefully it's going to be the last one this year.
God willing, yeah. We used to say, may this be the last war, right? And now it's may this be the last election.
Exactly.
Hamilchama ha'achrona, now it's like...
It's almost like Israel has a surfeit of democracy, like too much democracy, but that's not quite right. I want to thank Noah Levy for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and about your work?
You can look me up. It's academia.edu. And also I have a website at the Academic College of Tel Aviv Jaffa. And my published work is also on Academia Edu and Google Scholar.
Thank you so much, Noah.
Chag Sameach.
Thank you very much. And Chag Sameach. Chanukah Sameach.
Chag Urim Sameach.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson.
presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be author Heather McAdam, discussing her new book on the first Jewish transport to Auschwitz, All Girls and Women, called 999. Our playout this morning for this seventh day and last night of the holiday of Hanukkah comes from Matisyahu, his wonderful rap reggae song, Miracle. My friends, may you have a great final night of Hanukkah, Chag Urim Sameach, Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy Hanukkah, and a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.